Welcome to the Final Draft Podcast. My name is Andrew Popel, and today I'm joined on the show by Elizabeth Coleman. Now, here on Final Draft, we love exploring books, writing, and literary culture. Each week, I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. And at Final Draft, we are dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to the classics that you know and love. In each of these conversations, we look at the issues that drive the author's storytelling, help you discover more from the books you love, because these are the stories that make us who we are. Now, 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people, and I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, acknowledging these are unceded lands and treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. Today, I am joined on the show by an incredible writer across styles, genres, spaces. Elizabeth Coleman has written for television. She writes novels. And we are going to be exploring just an absolute fantastic romp of a detective story. It'll have you guessing. It'll keep you entertained. It's got a dog. So join me as we discover Elizabeth Coleman's A Dance with Murder. Elizabeth Coleman is a screenwriter and playwright. Her play Secret Bridesmaids Business has been adapted into a TV series. She's also written for Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, but today Elizabeth is joining us with her new novel. It is the second in her Ted Bristol mystery series. It's called A Dance with Murder. Elizabeth, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Andrew. Great to be here.
Now, in A Dance with Murder, Ted Bristol is trying to balance the personal and the private. Her latest case, protecting a ballerina from a stalker, is complicated by her burgeoning relationship with the ballerina's ex. Meanwhile, there are complicated couplings everywhere, and while Ted definitely wants to grow her PI business, she's hoping to avoid the body count.
Indeed, she is. Right, although she'd like the excitement of a serious crime, although, of course, she doesn't wish anybody did.
All right. Well, you know what, Elizabeth, you've gone there. We're going off script straight away. That is a really fascinating part of this because, of course, she's building her business. And so the drama helps her. I didn't particularly have any business-related questions, but that is a really fascinating part of this, the way Ted, I guess, has to balance building her business with the drama, the violence, the crime that entails.
Yeah. And the distress, the human distress it entails. Yeah, so she'll, you know, if a serious case kind of comes her way, she's like, her first thing is, yes, this is great for the business expansion plans and stuff. And then she has to pull herself back and go, hang on, it's not about me. It's not about growing the business. Because she's, you know, she's officially a civil investigator. So she's been, you know, finding missing chihuahuas, you know, cheating spouses, neighbourhood fence disputes, that kind of stuff. And she's just been yearning, particularly in book one, A Routine Infidelity. That was when she got her first actual crime. And so she's still new to it. And so it's really exciting for her. It's a real adrenaline buzz. But at the same time, she has to remind herself these are real people, you know, in really difficult, emotionally painful situations. Mm. So she's balancing the two.
Mm. We're putting the cart before the horse a little bit here. As you've mentioned, this is your second outing with Ted.
Yeah.
While she's, you know, racking up the cases, she's definitely not your grandparents' investigative sleuth here. I was wondering, could you give us a little bit more of an introduction into Edwina Ted Bristol and her investigative world?
Yes, thank you. Well, Edwina Ted Bristol, she's 36. She's the second daughter in a family of 9 kids with 7 brothers, 7 big, wolfy, blokey brothers. And she's had a tragic incident early in her childhood that she feels very guilty about, and she's been carrying a guilty secret for a long time. And she's kind of motivated by that she's very external, you know, she likes getting into a bit of a verbal biffo, and she's not afraid of ruffling feathers, but she's actually quite frightened of emotional depth and getting really close to someone, although she's starting to learn it. But the main thing about Ted is that she's lots of fun. She's not your kind of twee little let's have a cup of tea kind of person. She's kind of gutsier than that. You know, they use the term cozy crime. I kind of think of this as cozy crime with guts.
So yeah. I'm going to ask the next question before we get into the gory details of the narrative, and a question like this might feel a little gauche. I got the impression you're having a lot of fun with Ted. You're having fun developing her world. How do you balance the energy of a pacey detective story with all the darkness and the violence that inevitably are going to arrive?
It's really tricky, but I'm lucky. I wrote a lot of episodes of Mrs. Fisher's Murder Mysteries for the ABC, and I really learned then it's a really delicate tonal dance between, you know, witty remarks and sort of a kind of a lightness, fun feel, as opposed to the criminal aspects, because, you know, these are real people. This is a real dead person. There are real bereaved people left behind. And so it's really important that you're not sort of trivializing that or making it, belittling that. It is a really delicate tonal balance, but I do think I learned that on Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries for the ABC. Yeah. Mm. And so I've just kind of, and I wanted to dig a bit deeper into character because I didn't want to write, I had no interest in writing something that was just a procedural, you know, this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens. You know, my primary interest is character and kind of delving deeply into someone and finding out why they behave the way they do and why they set up self-sabotage and how that impacts on their relationships and even their work, and then chucking a crime in as well.
I guess though, because Ted is newer to the big crimes, you know, she's talking about how, well, I mean, she's newer to the big crimes. Let's not say too much because I don't want to give anything away from the first book either, but
yeah,
she is talking a lot about her processes, and that must have been fun though, being able to build a little bit of that into the narrative.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really lucky. I've got this fabulous female private investigator, Julia Robson from Online Investigations, and she's been amazing. She really helps me with Ted's process and to make sure that it's, you know, authentic. When I started writing it and I had the idea, I was kind of like, oh, well, everyone knows what a private investigator does. So I just started, and then I thought, oh, hang on, you know, you really need to dig deeper into, you know, her everyday processes and what she would actually be doing and how she'd actually be making a living. So, yeah, Julia's been really helpful for me with that. Mm.
Is that different? Because I like what you said there about, oh, everyone would know. And there, we live in a world that has kind of swallowed postmodernism and vomited it out whole. We have a great deal of insight into processes, but we also have huge blind spots that perhaps we're not even aware of. The contrast between something like Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, where not only did the internet not exist, we are talking pretty a lot of technology, versus a world where the internet can both make things seem so accessible but throw up its own, I guess, technical complications. Did you have to check yourself with what you might presume and not presume?
Yeah, I did. And I was always aware of thinking about what part technology played in Ted's investigations. For instance, in this book, A Dance with Murder, she goes on Tinder as part of an undercover operation. So obviously Miss Fisher wasn't able to do anything like that. So yeah, and Ted's a bit obsessed with her website and how many hits she's getting, and she's always checking into Google Analytics, and she's always worried about getting a negative Google review. So yeah, I was really aware of incorporating that kind of stuff into it.
Again, we will get to the narrative, but setting up, establishing is super important. And I think for listeners, just between you and me, Elizabeth, listeners know we're not going to give any spoilers. Like that's just a thing. People who listen to this show know they're not getting spoilers. So the setup is what's going to draw people in. It's, you know, the reader is going to have to trust Ted, trust that she's going to get the job done, but also that they're going to resonate with her. So I think it's important we have an obligatory dog question. Throughout the investigation, Ted is accompanied by her offsider, Miss Marple. Much like Ted, Miss Marple does not immediately strike the casual observer as a crack investigator. How did you want to play with expectations here?
Miss Marple, by the way, is a miniature schnauzer, Ted's beloved rescue dog, miniature schnauzer, and acutely intelligent colleague. I just wanted to play. I think I was inspired I had a beautiful miniature labradoodle called Hazel, who sat under my desk for 15 years. Every day I wrote, and she was just so loyal and devoted. And I think that's kind of what inspired Ted's devotion to Miss Marple. And then I liked the idea of having a dog who was aloof, because it so goes against the grain to have an aloof dog. And I just thought a miniature schnauzer struck me as the kind of dog that might be most aloof. So, yeah, that's why I'm trying to play with expectations there. And Miss Marple is an invaluable assistance to Ted. She doesn't do anything a dog can't do, except they communicate telepathically. You know, she's not a talking dog like a talking Mr. Ed, the talking horse or anything. Her and Ted have a telepathic link. But she's just a really smart, acutely intelligent dog, and she's helps Ted out. Like, she, for instance, she'll go and sniff it up. If Ted's got to serve papers on someone who's got a dog, Miss Marple will go and sniff the dog's bum to distract the person while Ted comes up to serve the papers and stuff. So she's actively involved in investigations.
And thinking about how actively she is involved in the narrative, I started to wonder, you know, writing dogs, surely a part of your brain as a writer must think a little bit from that telly and visual perspective that you've worked in as well. Because Miss Marple is such an involved canine, does that factor into your writing? Are you ever wondering how this might be realised on the screen?
Well, I've just actually written the first episode of a potential TV series. And, yeah, it was interesting how to communicate Miss Marple's talking, because, as I said, I don't want her kind of jaw moving, and I don't want to be doing some kind of Mr. Ed thing. I don't want anyone to hear her except for Ted, because it really is a telepathic link between them, and it only happens when their eyes meet. So, yeah, it was interesting. I was thinking, should I communicate that with voiceover, or should I communicate it with writing on the screen? Yeah, it was interesting. It's much easier to communicate in a novel, that's for sure.
It'll be fascinating to see how that's realised. I feel like cutscenes and close-ups are also going to play a big role.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of close-ups because, as I said, it's only when their eyes meet. You know, Miss Marple communicates her opinion, which is often quite acerbic.
So A Dance with Murder, you open A Dance with Murder with Ted on a date or on a case that involves a date. Ted's taken to the apps to help her track down the stalker of her client, Giselle Turetti. Across the novel, though, there are a lot of, I think people are assuming, this isn't a spoiler to say that Ted is on a date with someone who may salubrious fellow.
Yes.
Across the novel, there are a lot of question marks raised over the behaviour of men towards women. This is such a live discussion. It is such, I think, also a modern discussion if we contrast... And I don't mean modern in the sense that men's behaviour has changed over the millennia. Simply that women's position of power to challenge that has of course, shifted and evolved. Was this a particular concern for you, like looking at this through the lens of Ted and her investigations?
It wasn't what drove me, what was driving the narrative, but it just felt organic to the story and to what Ted was going through. And it also amused me. I mean, this guy she's on the date with is, you know, a secret misogynist in sensitive new age guy's clothing, you know, and I found that kind of amused me. Like, you know, he boasts about dating a model, but he says to Ted that it had nothing to do with her career. He was attracted to her self-actualization. But, you know, and Ted's thinking, well, I bet her self-actualization looked hot in a bikini. So it's just, it's sort of playing with those perceptions and looking. Yeah, I guess those male attitudes to women are throughout the book, but it wasn't a conscious, you know what I mean? It felt like organic to the story to me. I wasn't consciously setting out to make a statement about that.
I mean, of course, in this investigation as well, Ted meets men Ted is searching for someone whose behaviour has sort of crossed a criminal threshold. But she meets plenty of men whose behaviour it's not great, it's bad, but it doesn't cross that criminal threshold. Does Ted's position, independent of the police, allow her to better explore this sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, absolutely. Ted's small and she's really, really pretty. So that sort of helps her in those kind of situations. But I would say this, bad, you know, the women aren't all perfect in this book. And Ted herself behaves very badly at one point. So he certainly wasn't, I wasn't kind of making a statement about men or anything. That certainly was my intention.
I like the, you brought up Ted's imperfection, and we already talked a little bit how she is still relatively new to the investigation game. It was really interesting the way you play that inexperience off against the wisdom of a character like Auntie June, who Ted turns to for advice. And then we have the ineptitude of Cody Venables, who who causes more
well-meaning. He's very well-meaning.
He is very well-meaning, and I feel like that's probably a really good quality to have for a trainee in a sandwich bar, and less so for someone on a case.
Of course, that's a very good point.
Cody has his moment.
He does. He actually saves the day in the end. This is a very eager beaver young guy Ted meets, who failed to make it into the police force. So he set himself up as a surveillance agent, and he's a bit too keen for his own good.
I wondered, though, about this broad spectrum of experience, because, of course, detectives, we are familiar with detectives. The idea of the detective, like, sits in the cultural milieu. You do not have to think very hard to draw the idea of a detective to mind, but, of course, they are such a spectrum. Did the spectrum within the novel allow you to play with the possibilities in the story?
Do you mean this Ted being a private investigator opposed to
if Ted were just Ted on her own? I feel like she would have both come a cropper in some situations where perhaps she didn't have the experience, but also the story potentially, what's the best way to put this? The story could have been a lot more earnest, but maybe a little bit personally simple for Ted if she didn't have to deal with Cody occasionally.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Oh, yeah, no. Well, it's more, I mean, what's the point of getting her to employ a surveillance agent who does everything perfectly? I mean, there's no fun in that. So, and I already had her, she's very close with an Indigenous Wurundjeri woman surveillance agent called Auntie June, who's an older woman who is a former homicide detective. So she acts as a mentor to Ted. And when she gives Cody the job, admittedly, the job she shouldn't give anyone. When she gives it to Cody, she is trying to mentor him. But, yeah, she's it's not the wisest of decisions on Ted's part.
And it opens up, again, it opens up all sorts of possibilities because, of course, Ted is, isn't it interesting, Elizabeth, that a lot of popular detective narratives kind of create the illusion that somehow they just have one job, and it's always wondering, like, what are the economics of this? And of course, you show us that Ted's got to keep stuff going. You know, I'm sure it mirrors writing as well. For many writers in Australia, we understand that it is not always the best paying job, and you might have to keep some other things going just to make sure you make ends meet. This is exactly the same for Ted. She's got to keep a few things going.
She's got, small-time corporate espionage jobs, and she'll do due diligence for an American, for instance, if somebody applies for a job in the States with a big company, the big company might contact Ted and ask them to do a check on her, on this person, so that she does those checks. She makes money, and there's a lot of infidelity cases and, neighbourhood disputes, all sorts of things. So that's how she makes her money. But her true love, of course, is hardcore crime. When I say hardcore, I don't mean that in the sense it's never kind of grim or bleak. Like, it's a totally different style to that.
But also it might be. We're not giving away any spoilers. Grim is so relative.
Yeah.
Grim is so relative. And we can't talk about whether it does get too grim. We've given short shrift to Ted's family so far in our chat. In your introduction, you mentioned it's a really big family that she comes from. And again, the idea of the detective in our mind, the detective who exists in the sort of the cultural atmosphere, is so often a jaded loner.
Lone wolf, yeah.
Why give Ted such a large and supportive family?
Well, I thought I liked the idea of her, playing against that trope of the lone wolf detective. And in some ways she's alone because she's so frightened of you know, being vulnerable, and she has intimacy issues which she's so aware of. And at one point she puts a post-it on her computer saying, remember to get over your intimacy issues. But, yeah, she has a huge family. She's her older sister, Bob, is the older Roberta. Bob is the oldest person in the family, sibling. And they lost their mother when Ted was very little. So Bob's always been her surrogate mother, and she's just very close. They're very, really, really close. But what's interesting, I like playing with the fact that Bob has always protected Ted and has always been there for her. But Bob is very soft-hearted, and she's very vulnerable because she kind of she always greets the world with an open heart. And she's had people take advantage of her. And Ted is fiercely protective of her to the point of being sort of vigilante about it. And so I like the fact there's a constant push and pull between them. Bob's been used to looking after Ted her whole life. She's worried about Ted's issues now. Won't Ted ever meet anybody she really wants to be? Will she allow herself to find happiness with someone instead of putting all her love into Miss Marple? Whereas, and Ted's, but Ted thinks it's her turn to look after Bob. And so there's a lovely push and pull there that I really like. And in terms of their seven brothers, I just sort of kind of found it funny. They're a big, wolfy, masculine family. You know, they communicate by punching and grabbing each other in headlocks and stuff. And I just love the idea of a dainty little woman being part of that and giving as good as she gets. Mm. So, yeah, I just liked, yeah, I like playing against those stereotypes.
Just a thought bubble.
That's why I'm writing them too.
Just a thought bubble as you were talking there around, you know, what might be a part of making this work is, I think, again, we all have that experience of the story of a detective. We all, well, I don't know this, but I'm also going to say confidently, we all play with fantasies of what if we were a detective and how we, you know, we're armchair detectives. We're going to solve the case by episode two, even though it's an 8-episode series.
Yes.
But in real life, are the only times we only really get to be detectives in our family where, you know, there is closed off members, there are machinations, there are things that, you know, we have to infer rather than, you know, directly discover. Do you think maybe Ted's large family resonates with all of us who are family detectives?
Yes, absolutely. I hadn't thought of that before, but yes, absolutely. That's a really good point. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting though, with Ted's family, it's more, it's almost more about them trying to work out what's going on with her, which is kind of a nice dynamic. You know, she's the actual detective, but the family is kind of, what's her story, you know? Because she doesn't give much away, except to Bob occasionally. Mm.
But, of course, that comes with its own complications. And
it does.
Maybe we shouldn't be playing detective within the four walls of our kin. You used Ted's inexperience also to such great effect as she pries into her sister's business. You also seemed to be playing the long game here. And when I say long game, I'm talking like book three long game here.
Mm-hmm.
That is a comment. That's not a question. Is there anything you'd like to say, though, about the way Ted meddles in her family?
I'm happy with that young eager beaver surveillance agent, Cody Venables, we were talking about earlier. Bob is madly in love and Ted is just terrified for her. There's no evidence that this new boyfriend is a bad person in any way, shape or form. But in book one, Bob went through a terrible experience and Ted literally had to save her life. So she's just super, super hugely overprotective, and she actually employs Cody Venables to put Bob's new boyfriend, Raj, under surveillance, which ends up blowing up in her face. But, yeah, and it causes really the only huge rift she and Bob have ever had. But it's really funny getting there.
It happens at such an interesting point in the book too, where I think for me, because I've not read book one yet, so for me as I'm working alongside Ted, I'm learning a little bit about her. I'm maybe trusting that she is going to solve the mystery. It kind of throws a spanner in the works. And I think maybe a few readers might say, does she have any idea what she's doing? Like on the surface of it, it seems.
Do you mean in terms of the surveillance?
Yeah, it's just like it seems destined to fail. Surveillance.
Oh, yeah, no, I think that's great. And I love that. And it's because of her It's driven purely by emotion. It's not driven in any way by fact or by, you know, concrete signs about this guy. That's why it's doomed for failure, because she's rash, she's overprotective, she's being unwise, she's being too impetuous. And, yeah, it's destined to fail, which is great, because you can't succeed all the time. That would be a bit dull, I reckon.
It removes the illusion also, I guess, of the omniscient, indestructible detective, you know, the James Bond, Jason Bourne type of the person that you're along for the ride, but you don't for a second doubt that they are going to save the day, no matter what happens. And that gives you enormous scope to play with as you move through, because we know that Ted is not only potentially not going to be able to save the day, she might mess up in a catastrophic way.
She might ruin the day.
Yeah.
As opposed to save it, yeah. She's certainly got that potential.
There's enormous. Look, I've implied that I don't know. There's going to be a book three, dear listener. I've implied. Maybe I've let out a little hope into the world, but for now,
I think it would be unfair to leave the cliffhanger at the end of book two, wouldn't it? Be a bit unfair.
Yeah. But for now, dear listener, you have the opportunity to go out and enjoy Elizabeth Coleman's A Dance with Murder. Elizabeth has been joining me today. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about the novel.
Thank you. It's been great. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me today. Thank you for always tuning in to the Final Draft podcast. I love presenting new Australian writing, and I'm glad you enjoy exploring it. Thank you also to Elizabeth Coleman. Elizabeth's new book is called A Dance with Murder. Final Draft is recorded on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. This show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. You can stay in touch. Probably the best way to do that, just hit subscribe. It means that a new Final Draft will pop up in your podcast inbox. Is that what do we call it, an inbox? It'll pop up in your podcast feed every week. You can also get in touch with Final Draft on social media. Just search for @FinalDraft2SER. My name's Andrew Popel. I am going to be back very soon with more incredible conversations with Australian authors here on Final Draft. Till then, as always, happy reading. Bye for now.